It's 5:30. I'm Nora Flaherty, and you're listening to MPBN Radio. Ahead on Maine Things Considered this evening, Maine Somali immigrants feel the pain of a bank's decision to stop allowing money transfers to that country. And Governor Paula Page wants to restructure how Mainers buy electricity. Those stories in your Maine newscast just ahead. First, this national and world news from NPR. At 5:32, I'm Nora Flaherty with this look at Maine news. The search for an Edgecombe woman is over today as Lynn Crink's body was found in the Sheepscot River at about five miles from her home at about 2 this afternoon. Mrs. Crink was last seen Friday afternoon. Her body's being taken to the medical examiner's office in Augusta to determine the cause of death. Investigators say they don't suspect foul play. A search and rescue organization based in Orono has received permission from the Federal Aviation Administration to use unmanned aircraft systems, or drones.
This is just a vast improvement. Lower level, better resolution, and all weather.
Downeast Emergency Medicine Institute Director Richard Bowie says the FAA's permission will make DME's searches for missing people safer, easier, and more effective. Bowie says the not-for-profit organization conducts about 25 search and rescue operations per year all over New England. He says drones can fly lower, which means they can see better. The fact that they're quieter may mean better communication with lost or injured people. Drones can also live stream images instead of having to land before sending data. And although many have expressed concerns about drones' impact on privacy, Bowie says that's not really an issue here.
The idea behind this is not to be trying to look into people's backyards. We're orange and yellow and white and bright colored with strobes on the aircraft and everything. We're trying to let people know we're there. We're trying to accomplish a very serious mission, trying to find someone who's missing or lost. And just bear with us. We'll get the job done and get out of the way.
Bowie says the drones will be used alongside traditional search and rescue techniques like dogs and interviews. And the federal government has proposed removing most of the world's humpback whale population from the endangered species list. Fisheries experts at National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration want to reclassify humpbacks into 14 distinct populations and remove 10 of those from the list. Among those slated for removal, the Caribbean population, which travels to feeding grounds in the Gulf of Maine during the warmer months. Donna Weeding from NOAA Fisheries says protection and restoration efforts are now paying off.
We know that we're not done yet, but we do really find that this is an important success and contribution to conservation and recovery.
If the proposal passes, the humpback populations that are removed from the endangered list would still be protected under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. The public has 90 days to comment on the recommended changes. In weather tonight, periods of rain and a chance of wet snow and sleet in the west, lows in the mid-30s to mid-40s north to south. This is Maine Things Considered on MPBN Radio. I'm Nora Flaherty. 15 years ago, Maine restructured its electricity business, requiring power companies to sell off their generating facilities and become only transmission and distribution companies. Mal Leary reports Governor Paula Page says this policy has failed and he wants a major restructuring of the electricity business.
Starting in March of 2000, Mainers were supposed to gain an advantage by creating competition in the electricity business by separating the generation of electricity from its transmission and distribution. For more than a century, electric companies distributed electricity they generated or purchased and were regulated by the state through the Public Utilities Commission. Power companies enjoyed a monopoly in the areas they served, with rates subject to PUC oversight. Restructuring was supposed to lower overall bills because the generation market was open to competition, while distribution remained a regulated monopoly. Governor LePage says it clearly hasn't worked as planned.
Do you have an electricity bill at the end of the month? You tell me. I mean, I know that my bill is three times as much as somebody living in Montreal.
LePage says neither homeowners nor businesses have benefited from the restructuring. He's proposing that transmission and distribution companies, including Central Maine Power and Emera Maine, be allowed to build or acquire generating facilities with the approval of the PUC, reversing the policy change of more than 15 years ago.
It's the worst thing we could have done. I look what's happened to our cost. If they go up rapidly and they go up in huge amounts every year.
In 2014, Maine residential customers paid on average 12.66 cents per kilowatt hour. The national average was 10.45 cents per kilowatt hour. but Mainers was still paying the lowest rates in New England, nearly 3 cents less than neighboring New Hampshire, almost 5 cents less than Connecticut, which paid nearly 17 cents a kilowatt hour. Portland Representative Mark Dion, a Democrat, co-chairs the legislature's Energy, Utilities, and Technology Committee. He says he will need to be convinced that LePage's proposal to go back to the world of pre-2000 is the right one.
Our predecessors had determined that return the greatest benefit for ratepayers. So that's where I'll begin my line of questioning on this policy. What advantage to the ratepayers? Or are we asking them to take a new risk on an old idea?
Dion says the governor has several bills pending that would change Maine's electricity policies, and they should be looked at in their totality. Another measure would do away with technology-specific goals for state energy sources. Pat Woodcock is the director of the governor's energy office.
We have a goal for wind, the amount of wind to be installed in the state. We have goals for solar. We have goals for hydro. Actually, I look at energy policy as technology is a means to carry out policy. The actual policy that we should be looking for in our state is lower pollution, lower cost.
Woodcock says there are other bills coming from Governor LePage this session to change Maine's energy policy, ranging from encouraging development of new sources to improving energy efficiency. So far, none of those measures has had a public hearing. For MPBN News, I'm Mal Leary.
You're listening to Maine Things Considered on MPBN Radio. Still to come, the science of potato creation and Maine's newest variety. But first, Maine is home to an estimated 5,000 Somali immigrants, many of whom send regular payments to family members back home. This represents an important financial lifeline for many in Somalia and for that nation's economy. But recently, life got a lot tougher for Somalis trying to send money home. And as Tom Porter explains, lawmakers, aid groups, and Somali immigrants are concerned that a major crisis could unfold if the situation's not resolved.
High school teacher Abdullahi Ahmed of Portland has lived in the U.S. for 16 years. For as long as he's been able to, he's been sending between $150 and $200 every month to his sister back in Somalia. Ahmed says she has 7 children and few options.
She and her husband actually do not have any other, source of income other than what I send to her.
And that money, he says, is crucial.
That is the only way that she and her kids are surviving and can go to school.
Ahmed, who's now a U.S. citizen, says pretty much every Somali he knows in Maine who can afford it wires money back home on a regular basis.
Because back in Somalia, there's no government or help system out there. So this is very important aspect of the livelihood of Somalis back home.
And according to international relief agencies, these types of payments are an important part of the overall Somali economy.
Critical, absolutely critical.
It's an issue familiar to Scott Paul. He's senior humanitarian policy advisor with Oxfam America, focusing on East Africa.
Globally, Somalia receives at least $1.3 billion a year from its diaspora.
Which, he says, is more than the country receives in humanitarian assistance, development aid, and foreign direct investment combined.
Most of that money is used to meet people's most basic survival needs. So food, water, shelter, school fees, basic health care, and the like.
In February, Merchants Bank of California closed the accounts of Somali-American money transfer operators, and Merchants was the last major financial institution in the U.S. to offer the service. Some immigrants, including Abdullahi Ahmed of Portland, are still managing to find ways to wire money home for now, but without the help of major banks, it's more costly and harder to do. U.S. banks have been distancing themselves from Somalia.
The issue around this is banks have suspended this money transfer because they're worried that the money could fall into the hands of terrorist groups.
But Democratic Congresswoman Shelley Pingree says there's little evidence that groups like Al-Shabaab, the Somali-based organization behind a recent massacre of university students in Kenya, is actually getting much of this money.
Our understanding is, in the amount of time that's been going on, the last 2 decades, I think, there have been only 2 cases where a very small amount of money went to Al-Shabaab.
Pingree, who represents Maine's 1st congressional district, has joined with others in Congress in urging the Treasury Department to find a way around this problem.
it's not as if there was a significant problem. It's more that the banks are worried about the risks that they're taking on for being liable if the money gets into the wrong hands. So we've made suggestions that maybe there's some way to relieve the banks of the responsibility, or the federal bank could have some involvement in this. We have not found a solution.
Pingree and others warned that the economic isolation of Somalia could actually help terror groups like Al-Shabaab as more people flock to join their ranks out of economic desperation. Maine's other congressional delegates have also been giving their reaction to the situation. Republican Bruce Poliquin represents Maine's 2nd District, which includes Lewiston, where many of Maine's Somali immigrants live. In a statement, he says that as a member of the bipartisan task force to investigate terrorism funding, he'll be looking closely at the Somali payments issue. At the same time, he says it's important to protect those who are trying to help their families achieve better lives. U.S. Senators Susan Collins, a Republican, and independent Angus King issued a joint statement underlining the importance of balancing those two interests. While all parties hope to see this issue resolved soon, Oxfam's Scott Paul says in the long term, there's only one solution.
And that's for Somalia to develop a sustainable and inclusive banking system.
One that's considered trustworthy and reliable by the international community. For MPBN News, I'm Tom Porter.
Finally today, as you go about your shopping this spring, keep your eyes peeled for a new potato hitting the market. The Caribou Russet is the latest variety to emerge from the University of Maine Experimental Potato Lab. Jennifer Mitchell recently checked in to see how new potatoes are created and what makes the Caribou Russet so special when there are thousands of varieties to choose from.
The potato was brought from its native home in Peru to Spain and in time back to America, and now spreads its green over countless acres throughout the world.
It's the third most frequently consumed food crop worldwide. Today, the average American eats 142 pounds of potatoes per year. That's a slight dip since this 1940s film extolling the virtues of the spud was made, but demand is still strong.
A universal food for the millions and the millionaires.
With more than 7,000 wild and cultivated varieties of potatoes, consumers today are spoiled. But the push to create a better potato never stops.
There's no perfect potato variety. I suspect there's no perfect variety of any crop.
That's Greg Porter, who runs the potato lab at the University of Maine.
And as you release the new variety, you're trying to figure out the balance of what are the advantages. Does it have enough merit to be worthy of the investment that's required, both to continue research on it, but then to scale up and commercialize it?
The university has numerous potato experiments in progress at any given time, and it takes about a decade from the very first pollination to the point where the tuber is ready for a test market. Most will not make the cut, but one potato has. AF33621 was recently given a more distinguished name, the Caribou Russet.
All right, so what is different about this potato than what I would find, say, in the store right now?
Well, it has really high quality for both fresh consumption, so as a baked potato or as a mashed potato, and it also makes good quality French fries, healthier French fries than our standard varieties. From the grower's standpoint, it produces very high yields, with very good internal quality, nice white flesh, very little hollow heart, which is a common defect in most of our russet varieties.
If you've ever chopped open a potato and found a strange brownish spot with a cavity in it, that's hollow heart. It's a stress condition that occurs when the spud grows too quickly. And while not dangerous or unhealthy, it can look unappealing to consumers. The Caribou Russet is also capable of growing to a big size. Picture 8-inch long French fries. But how is the potato actually created? Matt Schulteis is a student at the lab.
I'm collecting pollen from individual clusters and then taking pollen from other plants and applying them to the stigma of individual other clusters that we have made for crossing by taking the anthers off and applying the pollen directly to the stigma.
Translation. Potatoes have both male and female organs. To get a new variety, the male anthers from one plant are removed so it won't pollinate itself. Then, using a modified electric toothbrush, the pollen of a second plant is collected and painted onto the female bits, the stigma of the first plant. Ideally, each plant will bring something good to the table. In the case of Caribou Russet, it has a strong lineage. Its parents included the Silverton Russet, which endowed it with high yields, and a Reeves Kingpin, which contributed the hollow heart resistance. But Caribou Russet has a big test in the coming months, the National French Fry Trials, where it will be assessed for fry quality at five different locations across the country. The holy grail of potatoes, says Porter, would be one with all the flavor of a classic russet, one that could still shine as mash with no hollow heart and strong resistance to the three most common blights and diseases. But experts say such a spud would be decades away. For NPBN News, I'm Jennifer Mitchell.
Well, at 12 minutes before 6 o'clock, it's time to check the weather forecast tonight with meteorologist Paul Janis.
As a series of low-pressure systems come upon New England over the next several days, we'll continue to see cloudy skies with a chance of showers right through the late week period. In the meantime, for tonight, we'll see periods of rain statewide with some wet snow and some sleet in the mountains of western Maine. Rain could be heavy over southern and coastal Maine. Patchy fog, lows 34 to 44, north to south. For tomorrow, look for a cloudy day overall statewide with rain showers. Rain showers may mix with snow across the mountains of western Maine once again, highs at 35 to 50. It'll be partly sunny at times on Wednesday across the state with scattered showers statewide, high temperatures in the mid-40s to mid-50s. Thursday and Friday will both be cloudy days with scattered showers across the state, 45 to 55 north to south. Saturday, mostly cloudy, some isolated showers, highs 45 to 55. That is my latest forecast. For the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, I'm meteorologist Paul Janis.
And that's Maine Things Considered. Thanks today to Keith Shortall, Ed Morin, and Barbara Caritti. I'm Nora Flaherty.